Welcome to the Lizzian Events podcast, and today I'm with my great friend, a man who I really respect for his intelligence and his viewpoints, Mr. Gary Longden. Hello, Gary, how are you?
Good morning, Ian. Very well, thanks very much for contacting me.
Good. Gary, today I'd like to talk to you about two aspects of your work, but one will be journaling and the other will be poetry. And I would first like to get people into the way that Gary's mind works. One of his fantastic poems has three lovely sentences in it. It says, "Mosques, churches and synagogues offer no prayers, while the aisles of Morrison's, Tesco and Aldi sing." What a fantastic evidence of Gary's mind and the way that he thinks. Great words. I love that poem so much, "My Town, Gary." I really do it. It's love it so much. I've got it printed, and it's by this very, very computer as I talk. Gary, can you tell the listener a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I have really been involved in writing one way or the other for most of my life. When I was at school, I was enjoyed English, and then in the it'll be in the mid to the late 70s, when the punk era musically broke, I started to freelance for a music magazine called Sounds, and that involved going to gigs, and in those days before mobile phones, it meant going to a telephone box afterwards, ringing through 500 words, and if it got printed, you got paid, which from memory actually was 25 quid, which back in those days wasn't bad, and if it didn't, you'd wasted your time. So that really introduced me to the joys of writing and getting paid for it. It also was a time when I was able to combine my passion, which at that stage was music, with what I enjoyed doing, which was writing. And I then had to move on to get a proper job, which was in a state agency, but my desire to write never really lost me, and left me, shall I say. And I found myself after a bit of a while with work becoming heavily involved with the newspapers. They quickly picked up the fact that I reviewed, and they then said to me, well, look, Gary, in addition to you providing advertising for us, why don't you do reviews of local shows, local theatre shows, as well as pop music, which I started to do. And that got me involved in theatre reviews, which is something which I have done up to this very day until the theatres closed down. So writing for me has always been part and parcel of what I do. The poetry scene has been something which probably evolved in the past 15 or so years. As a student, I had to do poetry because I had to. But then one day I went to a gig where the Buzzcocks were headlining, and underneath them there was a scrawny Manchester youth called John Cooper Clarke, who did a tremendous spoken word poetry set, and I realised that poetry didn't have to be staid and boring, and to do with esoteric things which had nothing to do with my life. Instead, it could be about the here and now, and that again was a lesson that I learned as a relatively young man, which although it didn't find its manifestation immediately, certainly came to me in later life, and that has resulted in my being involved in organising and running literary events, the most prominent of which is something called Poetry Alight in Lichfield, which has been running for about 8 years now. It's one of the longest running poetry events in the Midlands. And one of the things which I enjoy is I rarely actually read at those events. Instead, I take great pleasure from providing a platform for other people, young and old, to be able to express themselves and to be able to connect with people and the world around them as well. And I think that all of those things really combined with my long-standing interest in the well-being, mind, body, spirit area, and that has meant that I've become involved in publishing books, not only in writing them myself, but also in being able to help people to edit them. And I've been involved in various little presses as well, where we produce them. So really, words are my meat and drink, and I get a tremendous amount of pleasure out of it. And I hope that very occasionally some other people get some pleasure out of reading what I write as well.
Poetry is a very reflective process, Gary. What goes through your mind when you construct a poem? Is it spontaneous, or do you make a few notes? I'm asking this question because at this moment in time, there's a lot of listeners who no doubt will have some time on their hands. And when we've got time, I think there's never a better time to be reflective. So what's your process? How would you introduce somebody to this wonderful world of poetry?
I think that what I do is, computers are marvellous things these days, and you can create files for yourself. And what I do is I have a file called a poetry file, and in it are not my completed poems. Instead, what they are fragments of ideas. So it may well just be a couple of words about a subject. It might be a few lines. It might be the rough, really, of a poem, which I will try to complete, but often my inspiration runs out, and so I just have to leave it there, and then I will go and revisit it. I think that the process of actually writing something down to start off with is relatively easy, and the majority of what I write then is rubbish. What does happen thereafter is time starts to distill what you've written, and you think, do you know what, that really was not very good. But equally, very occasionally you come across material where you think, do you know what, I've really got something, and I work at it and work at it. And funnily enough, producing what I think is good quality work does take time, and it takes constant editing and application and honing and fashioning until you really have something which you're proud of. I think it's a bit like polishing a gemstone, and that is, you know, you've got something with that gem, but you've got to work on it, finish it, polish it, and refine it until you've really got something which you're proud of at the end. The only coda that I would add is one of my very good friends, Joe Bell, who is an exceptional poet, has a lovely saying, and that is that there's no such thing as a completed piece of work. There's just material in various stages of abandonment. And I think it's a lovely truism that although you do have to work hard at material, at some stage you have to say, that's as good as it's going to get, let it go and move on to something else.
I agree, because people sometimes ask me about the process of writing a book, and I say writing the book, the first draft is easy, but when you're down into the fifth or sixth draft of it, and the book is quite frankly driving you nuts, and you know you've got to just complete that last draft or you'll never be happy, that's the whole process. It isn't just that first draft. And I'd also completely agree with you. It is essential to make up your mind and say, enough is enough, I'll move on, because I think you can become stagnant if you keep going around too much trying to adjust things. But let's get back to somebody who's listening to this, and they're perhaps going through some really strange thoughts, because the vacancy that we have at the moment, to me, seems to be a great opportunity for thought. And it is also, again, I'll use this word, reflective. It's a reflective process. So if you were going to advise somebody to write their first words? Would it be would you say just write anything spontaneously and see what comes?
I would, but before that, I would encourage everybody to start off by saying to themselves, why? In other words, why are they writing this? Because I think that when we are writing down our thoughts, whether it is in a journal or whether it's in the form of some poetry, I think it's really important to be clear in your own mind as to who the audience is. Because I think that there can be two main objectives. The first one can be what amounts to therapy. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I think there's a huge amount to be gained from getting your thoughts down in writing, and you're actually writing it for yourself to be able to collate your thoughts, your emotions, your ideas, and just have something down about how you're feeling and what you want to do and where you want to go. But that is for yourself. You're not writing it for anybody else. The second objective can be because you feel that your own experiences, your own thoughts may have some value to others. And I think that if you are if you're doing that, what you're writing needs to be slightly different. And there's a lovely short phrase which comes from sales. When you're selling something to somebody, it's a question of when you sell it, you're saying to them what it means to that person. So you use the phrase, which means that. And so if you're writing down something, whether it's a poem or perhaps it's a book, or perhaps it's some sort of self-help guidance work, whenever you're writing something down, you always want to say, what does this mean to the reader? What relevance does it have for the reader? Who your primary school teacher was is interesting to you, but it's not to anybody else. If you're going to talk about your primary school teacher, it needs to be, you know, why are you mentioning that primary school teacher? What was the big lesson that you learned from that, which then relates to other people? So going back to your original question, the first thing is to ask why. Once you've said to yourself why, then I think you let rip and get down as much as you can on a stream of consciousness basis. In other words, whatever's in your head, you get it down on a bit of paper. You don't worry about spelling. You don't worry about grammar. You don't worry about anything. You just get those thoughts down, because once they're there, that's when the fashioning process can take place.
Yes, I keep a book, journal, and pens by my bed in my back. Well, you know, you wouldn't know about the bed, but you know about my always carrying a notebook with me. It's almost essential, because if you miss the moment, you lose it forever. I'm absolutely sure of that. Would you carry on, Gary.
Sorry, just worth saying that the other thing which I do, which is great these days, is that for all of us, actually physically carrying a book and a pencil is not necessarily easy or practical, but almost all of us have smartphones. And of course, on the smartphones, on everyone, there's a little memo facility. Mm. And I often use that just to record a little word or a phrase which resonates, and I will often refer back to those.
I agree. Also, get your video recording and self video your thoughts, so you can look at yourself while you're talking it, because you can get quite a nice revealing moment by seeing your face as you're putting out your thoughts. You can really relate to it, because my feeling is when you resonate with somebody's work, you're actually going deeper than the words. I believe that you're actually going into the very spirit and soul of the writer. So when you resonate with something deeply that somebody else has written, I think that you're finding answers and almost seeds of thoughts which can take you to, through a cathartic aspect of your life, to make very tangible changes. And I also think that when you're writing, I love the idea of saying, why am I doing this? And there's also, I think there's another thing worthy of consideration. I think you should also write about the times when you're deliriously happy and say, why am I so happy? Do you not think that's important, that you should not only just look at the darker sides, but the brighter sides are also worthy of great comment?
I wholly agree with that. And I think I'd go further in and say that it's only by including the periods of happiness and joy that those moments of despair and darkness can really be brought into sharp relief, because otherwise it's just a one-dimensional view, and that loses its impact. You have to have that light and shade. And I particularly enjoyed you saying that one should not only be talking about those periods of happiness, but why you were happy and what was contributing to that happiness and what caused that happiness and what you can do to be able to sustain that happiness as well.
Yeah, because my feeling is that people miss we read many spiritual books, and like yourself, when you become, if you like, zoned in, focused on and looking at spiritual work, for me as a writer, I'm sure people will find this quite a conceited comment, but actually I find a lot of spiritual writing, one, sterile, and two, almost totally repetitive from book to book. They find it almost difficult to bring up new concepts and ideas, and I know it's difficult to do. But I think that a lot of the common ground that we see at the moment is that word, the moment, and also looking to the future. But I believe that one of the most important things is the process, the actual process of whatever you're doing at the time. So if you're reflecting upon why you're so happy, you can soon start to understand the process of what makes you happy. And if you reflect upon the things that are not working so well, you can, if you're in depth, you can look at the process of why you're not doing so well in life. And that's why I think that, you know, when I talk to you, there's always a spark. You always leave me with something to think about the process of thought and the process of the why we do things, the reason for. And I think this is imperative. If you want to shine as a reflective writer, your statement of the reason for, and my feeling that there is a need to understand the process, is imperative to get good results. What's your feeling?
Yeah, I think that if you tell me that you're happy, I'm pleased for you, but really that's the end of my interest in it. If you actually tell me why you were feeling happy, what things contributed to make you feel happy, what you were doing to ensure that you are happy tomorrow, next month, and next year, those things are much more interesting to me, because those are things which I can apply to my own life. And I think that in our writing, those are the things which we need to be thinking about. It's the another sales adage comes in here. It's the so what test, isn't it? If somebody says something to you and you can say so what to it, you need to think again. And
I agree.
Think that when we're writing, I think that applying that so what test is important. And I think that that whenever you have written something, if you do want to, say if you're just writing it for therapy reasons for yourself, that's absolutely fine. And a lot of writing is like that. But I think that if you want it to reach a broader audience, you do need to have the courage to let other people look at it and see what they think, because there can be a huge difference between what you think that you've said and what the other person has heard. And obviously I do a lot of work with Jane Osborne, with her regression writing, and I've just lost count of the number of times when I've written something or she's written something and it's become very apparent that what we thought that we had said or what we meant to say was not what the other person was reading when they read it. And I think that's just such a vital lesson. And I think that at the moment, obviously, the coronavirus pandemic is dominating a lot of people's thoughts. And I tend to try to watch the daily press conferences. And what's fascinating is that the experts, the scientists, on the whole, speak very well. But the number of occasions when the experts have expressed an opinion or a view, and a journalist has had to come back and perhaps ask a question two or three times to clarify it, and that just demonstrates how difficult it is actually to ensure that what we want to say and what we mean to say is received by the listener in the way that the speaker had originally intended. And so it doesn't matter whether you're at a government press conference or whether you're writing something for people to read on the internet or perhaps for a future book, really double checking and saying to yourself, just ensuring that what you've said is what other people are going to understand is vital.
Yes, there's two points I want to just pick up on. It's very interesting about that statement that you made when you said, you know, if you say you're happy, that's fine, I'll close to that. But the reason for the happiness, I'll give you a slight example to that. Somebody said to me quite recently, why do you like using film cameras and why do you write about them? And is there still an interest? Well, indeed, there is an interest. But when I told her the reason that I like using them, she was aghast. She was just rabbit in headlight, because I said to her, I'm using this camera. It's called a Contax 2. And whoever bought this in 1953, when they purchased it, it was the equivalent of 4,300 euros today. And I said, if you think about that thought, I always think about the person who bought it and where that camera has been and what images has been taken with it, because whoever owned that Contax in 1953 was clearly a very wealthy human being. And they have to be. You're just not going to have access to it. And they were known for that reason. And so you've got, there's more to it than just that taking of the photograph. And I think you've got to look at things in a more deeply expansive way. But what is interesting is the clarity that you were talking about, the reason to be clear in your writing. And I want to come to that in a moment when we talk about journaling. But I also think that if you want your work to be read, it doesn't make any difference if people do not like it or not. It will resonate with somebody, and it will resonate with somebody very deeply indeed. And they're the only people, to my mind, that matter. If people criticize it, well, they can close the book and throw it away. It doesn't make any difference. So I feel, and I'm really interested in your opinion on this, I believe any form of writing, if it's from the mind, you have to be brave to make the statement. Don't conform to what you think other people want to hear.
Well, I think that's essentially it. And I think that for most people, certainly myself, although on the one hand, I like listening to people who share similar views and values to myself, when they don't, I'm just as interested, because I want to understand why they think what they think. And so long as those opinions are explained and they are and they're vindicated in terms of supporting evidential work, then I think that is absolutely fine. And I think that when you look at the internet these days, there's a phrase called, you know, clickbait. What essentially clickbait is provoking you to be able to read something. In reality, in our writing, I think that clickbait, saying something to get a reaction, is no bad thing. I think what is vital, though, is that what we're saying does resonate, because you've explained well why you feel the way that you do. And I'll just give you a little example. It's really what turned me on to the mind, body, spirit scene. When I was 16, I was reading D.H. Lawrence's Sons and Lovers for O-level, which shows my age. And in that, he talks about being at the Goose Fair with his girlfriend, which in itself is pretty unremarkable. What he says is that he experienced the joy at the Goose Fair, which even then had been going for hundreds of years, which exceeded his own joy, which exceeded the joy of him and his girlfriend. It exceeded the joy of him and his girlfriend and all the people there. He said it was as if all the joy that there had ever been at the Goose Fair was present that day. And I understood instinctively what he meant. And for me, that's a really good example of being able to express something in a way which engages others. If he just said, I went to the fair and had a good time, that really doesn't interest me and it doesn't engage with me. But the way that he explained it really made me engage with that moment. And I thought to myself, do you know what? I've had those moments of exceptional joy where it seemed that the joy was greater than the moment, greater than the people I was there. And being able to write in such a way that you can express that, that's where you really score.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in a way, that's the condensation of the camera scenario, isn't it? It's the, you know, it's the...
Absolutely.
That's where it's at. I mean, I it's, you know, to me, I think Stiletto's Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, when the statement's made, which has gone into our language, commonplace language today, which is "Don't let the bastards get you down." He's on that lathe, and he's, you know, he's pacing the amount of bearings that he makes, because if he makes too many, they'll up the quantity, and if he makes too few, he won't make his bonus. And there he is, he's making these incredible amounts of money that's better than anybody else, and then out he is drinking it on a Saturday night and with his affairs and all the things that he's doing. I mean, the whole book is it gives a purpose to the Rally Factory, and it gives a purpose to the environment that Stiletto knew so very well. And so the whole book itself to me is alive, and it's that drive, isn't it, that you get when you're reading something that is totally beyond the story. It's like when you read something like Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, that you become encapsulated with it, don't you? The book itself is more than a story. It's the way of the era, the way of the moment. It's all of these things. I mean, it's like if you read Nordic Noir, the stories are horrific, absolutely horrific. And I'm reading quite a bit of Nordic Noir at the moment. I mean, and the work that you read that was read in the early 70s, I mean, some of the stories you would hardly get away with today, you know, child abuse and, you know, quite detailed. Particularly, you know, The Man on the Balcony, particularly. but it's the books are more than the stories. It's the atmosphere of the day, the political intrigue, the drabness of the winters. All of these things make the story far more than just the story. You're so right about having to get more in your work. So let's go a little bit further. If you were journaling today... I was talking about journaling with Rick last week, and I think you might have heard some of it. But the one thing that I said, which I think is most important of all, is when you journal, it's a reference of the moment for you to reflect back on, because sometimes we have a tendency to distort that which has actually occurred. But my first thing is I always put the date at the top of the book, or I suppose when you're doing your voice recordings, I'm sure, well, I know the dates already be there on your voice recorder, so it's not so much of a problem. But how would you guide somebody at this moment in time, and why do you think it would be important for anybody but anybody to pick up pen, paper, or use that recorder just to reflect their thoughts? Why? Because we're going through a very monumental moment in time.
Yeah, I think that the people may underestimate quite how extraordinary a time we are in. I was talking to to one of my grandchildren a couple of days ago, and I said to him, you're absolutely special, Harry. And he said, well, what do you mean? And I said, you're going to be the first child amongst the first generation of children that will be off school for several months. And he said, well, what do you mean by that? And I said, well, universal schooling for kids only started in 1870, and there's never been a time when, apart from school holidays, children have been off. It is special. It is unusual. And I think that when you look at some of the great pieces of writing that have been in recent years, perhaps you can think about Nelson Mandela's biography when he was imprisoned in that island off South Africa. You think about Anne Frank when she was hiding in the attic in Amsterdam. That they were extraordinary times, and I think that extraordinary times prompt us to reassess everything that there is around us. Normally, we take what there is around us for granted. And I think that one of the features of the times that we're in at the moment is that absolutely everything is being reassessed around us. And I think that if you actually write down how that is affecting you here and now, and why you're feeling that, is just so important. And it goes back to the Kipling poem. See if I can just remember the key words, but it'll be how, why, what, when, and there's another one which I've forgotten just now. But if all the time you were saying to yourself, how do I feel this? How am I feeling this? Why am I feeling this? When do I feel this? Where do I feel this? That actually provides you with such a rich vein of prompts to be talking about the here and now. And I think then what's important, and you're so right about dating it, is that things are changing so quickly, and things are changing at a pace which we just can't anticipate at the moment. We don't know what next week, what next month is going to be like. Your response to those how, when, what, why questions in a month's time may well be very different from now. So having, to use an analogy from yourself, or having that snapshot from your camera of how things were in the first week in March as opposed to the first week in June, I think is absolutely invaluable.
It is. And I also have, I write using four colours as well, and each colour has a significance. For example, green is the earthly plane that I'll write on, and red is my emotions, blue is my intellect, and my violet colour is my spiritual creative thoughts. So I can instantly look through a book and see where I'm focused on at a certain period of time. But the other thing I do is I have a 1 out of 10 out of 10 feeling at the time. So I write the date, and this morning I'm looking at my diary and it says 8.5 out of 10. So that's my feeling of my general state of consciousness at the moment, is pretty good. But I think that it might be also worth people in some way making clear observations of those who are around them and watch very carefully at how they are going to change over the next 6 to 8 weeks, because never ever will we have a better opportunity to see how people will, let's use the word perform, Barry. I was talking to Barry earlier about this idea about performing and the way that we're going to perform. I think that, Gary, that the point is here, is that if you observe those around you and see how they perform, give them a scale of 1 to 10. Over the next 2 months, you're going to find the capacity of people in their darkest and sometimes their most uncomfortable or insecurest of moments, what we're going to experience now.
I wholly agree with that. And I think that I'd say that over the past month or so, I've been running Zoom poetry groups. And those have been really useful when it comes to providing prompts for people. But perhaps the most, the most telling point of that, actually, Ian, was in the past few ones which I've done, just towards the end, as we've been wrapping up, a couple of people have said, no, goodbye, and I look forward to joining you again, because do you know what? I'm going to be on my own now. And we are in a period of a lot of people feeling really isolated. So providing platforms and forums for people to connect is just so important. And I don't mind saying to you that there were two women in particular who, when they just said, I'm going to be on my own now, and they said it separately on different occasions, and it really struck a blow. And I thought, do you know what? I have got people to speak to. I have got people I can connect with. And these people, once this session ends, are just going to be on their own within those four walls. And I think we need to be very mindful of those individuals.
Yes, I think that I love the idea of Zoom. I like the idea of connecting people up. I've got some quite interesting plans for Len later on, but I'm not rolling them out now, because I'm watching very carefully. There is a lot of Facebook Lives and things of that nature. But sooner or later, people will run out of steam because one individual just can't keep talking to a bunch of people all day long. They're, in the end, they're going to run out of steam. And if you look at the comments, I've screenshotted a lot of the comments, which is my way, of course. And I'm referencing these because I want to see how the comments change over the next few weeks, because I believe that there's going to be the euphoria and the drive will go, but then the pressure comes on. You know, it's like the Scott to the Antarctic, isn't it? You know, if you watch the film, there they are. They unload all of their machines and they're all ready to go. And you know in the background that they should have had dogs, and you know the machines are going to seize and everything. And they get so close, and right at the end, you know, he's only 12 miles away from safety, but they, all through all that battle, they give up. And I believe that that film is a great analogy for human endeavour. There are very few Scots and Oats about. The real reality is, as we've just seen, it's, I've got to have all these toilet rolls and all the rest of it, and I don't give a toss. But, you know, I said to somebody yesterday, and they looked at me, I was doing a FaceTime with a friend, and she looked at me a bit gone out, because I said, you know, I'll tell you something about all these people who are hoarding and all these people who are stripping these shelves out. And they're like all the people who, you know, buy all pornography and everything else. Nobody buys it, but there's millionaires behind it. Somebody must be buying it. I think, you know, expose the hoarders. If you know one, let them go. Because the truth to the tell is, if you really are quite observant at the moment, you don't have to know who it is or what it is, but you can actually see what lays below human nature.
I agree.
I just felt compelled to add something in there.
Mm. And that is that you were just referencing their human nature and the inevitability and the unchangeability of it. When you actually do look at what's going on, the cycle is really predictable. And one of the things, of course, which is coming up now, is what I call quack solutions. You know, in other words, people are coming up offering sort of madcap theories on diseases and also sort of snake oil salesman type cures for what's going on as well. And people think that may be unique to the modern age of the internet, but it's not. It's always been there, hasn't it?
It most certainly has. It was interesting. I was born on the 13th of August, and in 1961, the Berlin Wall was begun on the 13th of August. And the very strange thing was that in 1989, I was actually in Berlin and I was staying at a hotel called Studio 39. And in the middle of the night, I had a banging on the door and the concierge came up and he said, "Get up, get up, get up." And I said, "Is there a fire?" He said, "No, there's people everywhere." And I walked down from my hotel and looked along the place I was staying, and there was people left, right and centre. And I walked up to an area and I actually watched this wall being knocked down, and I was actually there. Fact, not fiction, I was there.
That's incredible.
Now, the point is this, is that the following day, I was there on my own. I was on my motorcycle and I parked my motorbike up and I went for a drive around West Berlin. And then in the old days, you used to have to go around the Berliner Ring and get into East Berlin by one of the entry routes. To get into to West Berlin, you used to go along the corridor and you used to go into Potsdam and then you used to go wait and queue and in you went. But this particular day, I just jumped on my Kawasaki ZX-10, and it was new machine, and I drove into East Berlin, and I saw the wooden trams, and I parked up and had a quick look down one of the U-Bahns, went straight back to 1930. But the most important thing is, people thought I was on a spaceship there was people pointing at me. They couldn't comprehend what they were looking at. So that evening, I came back and I went into a restaurant, and the restaurants in West Berlin at the time were, they used to have what's called hospitality tables, where perhaps 12 or 13 people, if you were on your own, for some reason it's always been taken as a transient city, a city of loners and solo people who fly solo. And I was sitting at this table, and there was a lovely old lady, and she looked at me and she said, "You're drinking perfect English," said, "You're drinking that wine too cold." She said, "It needs to be drunk warm." And I got into this conversation with this lady, must have been in her 80s or perhaps, you know, that age. And I inevitably, I said, "What do you think about what's happening at the moment?" And she said, "It is inevitable, my friend. Humans will always change. They will always evolve." And then I got into the conversation and I said, "Did you ever see the Führer?" And she said, "Of course I did." She said, "I can remember him going along the Kaiserdamm in his six-wheel Mercedes, and the crowds were 25 people thick, all saluting and cheering this monster." She said, "In 1945, when we were in this city and we were chipping at bricks to rebuild buildings, and young girls were prostituting themselves to American soldiers for a bar of chocolate, etc. She said, "You couldn't find anybody who recognized themselves as liking or following that man." And I think that was one of the most powerful things that I've ever listened to in my life, ever. This juxtaposition of how people will change. And I think that at this moment in time, it's no use contemplating how we are now or how we have been over the last few days. I think the strength and mettle of us all now is going to be in 3 to 4 weeks' time, when it really starts to sink in, the enormity of the situation. Therefore, do you think it's so important to reference your thoughts, not what you're doing on social media, but you marshal your own thoughts at this moment in time, Gary?
Yeah, I think that that your points there about the changeability of our emotions and our feelings is absolutely key, because all of us only feel and respond to what there is around us at any given time, and so capturing that moment as of now is vital, because that moment isn't going to be there again. And then revisiting that in, as you say, 3 or 4 weeks' time, and saying, "How did I feel back then? How do I feel now? Why did I feel what I felt back then? And why do I feel as I do now? And what am I likely to feel in the future?" And in some ways, it can be particularly good fun in a time of great uncertainty, of guessing, predicting what's going to happen in the future, and then looking back and seeing the extent to which you were right, which will always be very satisfying, but also looking at where you were wrong and understanding why you were wrong, which perhaps will help us all to just anticipate the future a little bit better.
Yes, so by marshalling your own thoughts, by writing your own thoughts down and keeping those initially on a personal level, then later on, you can reflect back and say, you know, why did I think like that? What gave me that inclination to think in that way? Was I driven by mass thought, or was I driven by personal thought? You see, I think that you can enrich critical thinking at this moment by actually thinking right back to where you say, why am I thinking like this? What, how, when, where, why? These questions are imperative to one's security. And indeed, if in 6 to 8 weeks' time you can look back, and then the real journey becomes, because there'll be a lot of people feeling like they've just had a 2 week holiday, but they've just had an 8 week holiday. There'll be resistance to start to move again. Their modus operandi will have changed. Their mindset will have changed. Their desire to do things may well have changed so dramatically. They may well turn around and say, well, I'll tell you what, I've just done my garden. I've looked after my home. My house is immaculate. My clothes are clean. I wash every day. I feel absolutely fantastic. Perhaps I don't need to earn all this extra money. And you may well find that people will be saying, come on along, I'm not doing these excessive overheads, these excessive hours and things in nature, I'm not prepared to pay colossal amounts of money for property. There's a lot of debt to be paid, and of course that's going to affect a lot of things financially. I mean, the value of things almost certainly have got to suffer because of people's financial situation in a few months' time, Gary.
I think that there's a huge challenge coming down, which people haven't even started to really contemplate on a micro level. Jane's children own an estate agency business, and clearly the property market has shut down. But we were talking about this last night, and we're saying, if a surveyor was to go out and try and value something now, how could you possibly value it? And at what point in the future are you going to have confidence that a house is worth anything? Because you're going to have a volume of transactions in order to be able to provide some sort of substance to that valuation. And I can remember in Birmingham, this goes back in the early 90s, flats which had been selling for £80,000 back then were suddenly only selling for £12,000.
Yes.
People thought that was impossible. No, you know, if you'd said that to people that before the market crashed, nobody would have believed you. But it did happen.
Yes.
And I think that you're absolutely right when you talk about a reassessment of the capital value of material things. But I also think that all of us will be reassessing our relationship, not only with the economy, but with the people around us, and also with our environment as well. So, and I think that the good news, the upbeat part of all of this, is I think for those of us who are involved in the well-being, mind, body, spirit area generally, I think that there will be a massive resurgence of interest in those things which are greater. Because again, going back to history, I think with man, you often get this cycle of we think that we know everything, and then we discover that we don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so people start to look at things, beyond the immediate. They look for answers to those questions beyond the immediate. And I think that we may well be entering that time now.
I completely agree with you, and I do believe that people need to be very reflective about how they are going to negotiate the times ahead. When I say reflective, I mean reflective now about how they're going to negotiate the times ahead, because there will be changes and there will be situations that will never ever return to what they used to be. And I also, again, you see, I think that this is why you've got to be so cautious about how you look at other people and look at other people's actions, because what might be right for yourself could be completely wrong for somebody else. And people have every right, so like providing they're not causing discord, pain or danger to somebody else, people still have the right to free thought and free ideas, because without them, we stagnate, Gary.
Absolutely. No, I mean, it's vital that you have to have people who are challenging the boundaries all of the time. And perhaps it goes back to that word which has come up so frequently in our conversation, and that is why.
Mm.
All the time saying why. Questions tend to be the answer. So I think for all of us, in virtually all of the situations, whether it's our writing or our dealing with the changing world around us, the more times we ask the question why, I think the better off we all be.
Great. Gary, that's most stimulating of conversations. I'm hoping I'm going to entice you back over the coming weeks to discuss other matters. Have you anything you'd like to say to people who are listening to this, bearing in mind that we do now have quite a substantial amount of people who listen to us on iTunes?
I think that my broad message would be to use the time that the extra time that we have wisely, to be able to ask ourselves questions about what really matters, what is important, and unsurprisingly, ask the question, why are those things important to us? Why are we doing things the way that we used to do them, and why should we be doing it that way in the future? And if we use this downtime to be able to ask those questions, I think that we can fashion a better future for all of us.
I don't think you'll get wiser words today, Gary. Thank you so much for being with us, and I've no doubt in my mind that many people will be able to take a great deal from this. So get your phone out and make your thoughts on your memo, or get your pen and paper out. And I'm sure Gary would like to read some of your poems if you'd like to throw them at Len and anything you want to write.
Absolutely delighted to.
Great. Thanks, Gary. Great to speak to you.
Thank you very much.